Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 136. My name is John. Well, people, I've been here before. I know this room, and I've walked this floor. I just happened to run across a piece written by Marv Wolfman nearly 3 years ago. In it, he reflected on reading superhero comics during his childhood, and later becoming a comic book writer. He wrote, quote, "As much as I loved the stories and characters, I was getting older and wanted them to mature with me. I didn't avoid change. I embraced it and hoped for it. But not everyone thought the same. Many of the editors and creative talent didn't want anything to change. They loved comics as much as I did, but I think they wanted them to be the same as the ones they read as kids." End quote. I don't think I could have picked a better time to run across that quote. After watching Zack Snyder's Justice League, I've been thinking about how the same comic book character can have different stories across different media, aimed at different ages. This podcast never does spoiler-free anything and will contain spoilers for Zack Snyder's Justice League. So, if you haven't watched the Snyder Cut, get on HBO Max and check it out. Changes to characters have been with me my entire life. I grew up on DC Comics. It started in 1978 with Challenge of the Super Friends, the reason I woke up at 7 a.m. on Saturday mornings. In 1979, in the first comic book I ever bought, Flash's wife, Iris, was murdered. Quite the contrast compared to the children's cartoon for a 7-year-old. Those first few years, DC still had its original multiverse. They would get rid of it in 1985 in order to make their characters more easily accessible to new readers. Even though Crisis on Infinite Earths wiped it all out, Elseworlds gave readers brief glimpses into alternate realities. Later, Hypertime expanded the idea even more until, 20 years after DC destroyed it, the multiverse returned. There are all kinds of crazy concepts out there. Some of them work. Victorian-era Batman from Gotham by Gaslight. Communist Superman from Red Sun. Some don't work. Batman as an avenging priest from Holy Terror comes to mind. It doesn't have to be some bizarre twist on a character, rather just a subtle difference from one alternate continuity to another. Jonathan and Martha Kent are both alive, or both dead, or Martha's a widow. In some of these alternative realities, the heroes fight against each other, or are killed off by various evil forces. In some of these realities, they unite as a different version of the Justice League. And on top of all that, the Justice League itself has gone through several changes from the original team fighting giant starfish and pink demons, to the powerhouse satellite era that I grew up on, to the sitcom-esque Keith Giffen era, to the Pantheon of Gods take by Grant Morrison, to the New 52 by Geoff Johns, to the multiverse-shattering cosmic craziness of the current Scott Snyder League. And that's just the comic books. That doesn't include the animated television shows and direct-to-video movies, or the live-action proto-leagues from Smallville or the Arrowverse shows. The team has gone through so many styles and iterations, there's something for just about anyone who likes superheroes. And through all of it, I grew up. I was a teenager when Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns opened mainstream American comic book readers to new possibilities by positioning the characters for adult readers. These weren't just children's funny books or morality plays trying to tackle real-world issues with melodrama marginally better than an after-school special. They were works of literature, complete with psychological deconstruction and political commentary and satire. Comics had always been G and PG rated fare, open to all audiences. These stories showed that the characters could work in an R-rated setting as well. I embraced it. I still like classic comic books, and I will occasionally go back and reread them. But I love the mature stuff, too. Just like Marv Wolfman, I grew up, and I wanted my superheroes to grow up as well. They don't always have to be grim and gritty, but neither do they have to be sunshine and roses all the damn time. If you want to watch Cyborg with your preteen kids, watch Teen Titans Go! If you think your kids can handle R-rated shows, watch Cyborg and Doom Patrol. Both work for their target audience. There's room for all of it. Maybe because it was introduced to me in 79 when I was only 7 years old, with a wide open imagination, but I never had a problem with the concept of the multiverse or keeping track of alternate versions of characters. In fact, if anything, it still serves me well today. I try my best to go into any version of a superhero or team of superheroes thinking, okay, this is another alternate reality I've never seen before. The filmmaker's vision may be quite different from mine. If you go into the Christopher Nolan Batman movies expecting to see the Adam West campy version, you're going to have a bad time. If you're going to make a Justice League movie, you've got a lot of different possibilities to draw on. The satellite era is my favorite, but I can't go into a new comic book, television show, or movie expecting to see that version. Even when I saw the roster for the Justice League movie, I knew not to expect a direct interpretation of their New 52 origin, despite the similarities. The more expectations you have going into a superhero movie, the more likely you are to be disappointed. I knew some of the difficulties going on with the film during production. I knew the director was fighting to maintain his vision, while the studio was pressuring him for a lighter tone. However, Zack Snyder left during post-production due to the suicide of his daughter. Joss Whedon was brought in to finish the movie, and I would wager under direction of the studio to reshoot scenes to force that lighter tone now that Snyder was no longer there to advocate for his. Knowing all that, I went into the theatrical version of Justice League with simple expectations. I knew from Joss Whedon's other work that, compared to Zack Snyder's first two DCEU movies, this film would be more accessible to casual comic book fans and mainstream audiences, sprinkled with corny one-liners, relatively shallow, brighter, shinier, Disney-fied, generic, fun-for-the-whole-family popcorn fare. Not that this is a bad thing. There's obviously a huge market for movies where heroes never question themselves, and you sit through a predictable 2 hours without ever doubting the heroes will be victorious. I'm getting the watered-down version of Justice League, so be it. I even stated as much in my podcast reviewing the theatrical release back in 2017. Did I want the lighter tone? No. I didn't want DC to try to make their version of a Marvel movie. But I didn't get to choose. The studio made that call for me and for the rest of the fans. So, I took what I could get. All that mattered when I went into the theater was I wanted to see my favorite superhero team be heroes. And they were. I saw it opening night with my wife. Over the next few days and weeks, I had friends call me up wanting to see it, and knowing my love for the characters, asked me to come with them, so I ended up seeing it 7 times. I'm not saying the theatrical release of the Justice League was a great movie. I'm saying it gave me exactly what I expected out of it. I was fine with it. Opening night, people in the audience cheered when the credits began to roll. there was a clear divide between critics and moviegoers. I think there are some critics that are anti-Zack Snyder because of the themes in his movies and will automatically write negative reviews whatever he does. I think there are some anti-DC critics who automatically write negative reviews to attempt to take viewership away from the brand. Even though the Snyder Cut is exponentially better than the theatrical cut and the reviews reflect that, I still read some negative reviews that made me scratch my head and wonder if they were even really watching the movie to begin with. I ran across one article listing all these supposed plot holes in the movie. There were a couple of valid points, but for some of the things listed, the writer missed key visuals or lines of dialogue that explained what was going on. Additionally, the writer cited things said and done exclusively in the theatrical release, or even in some later DC movies, as problems with Zack Snyder's Justice League, even though it's been made clear that whatever happens in the Snyder Cut stays in the Snyder Cut. Nobody who's reviewing the movie for a comic book website should be making such glaring mistakes. So, was this writer clueless as to what the Snyder Cut was supposed to be? Or were they looking for a reason to write a negative review? It's not a perfect movie. I'll get to that in a moment. But nitpicking over things like the aspect ratio, calling it pretentious, or getting butthurt because Batman says he's going to fucking kill Joker, is so petty. It makes me wonder if there isn't some pre-existing bias. So, I guess when it comes to how the cinematic Batman is supposed to treat the Joker, it's perfectly okay to tether the clown prince of crime to a stone gargoyle while he holds onto a rope ladder from a helicopter until he loses his grip and plummets to his death. However, it's a cardinal sin for the Dark Knight to say he's going to fucking kill the sociopath who murdered countless people, including his sidekick. I don't get these sad little neo-Puritans wringing their hands over Batman dropping the F-bomb and threatening Joker. But frankly, I envision them as the kind of people who ran to their mother crying as children because their sister called them a duty head. Doesn't Batman always use threats and intimidation on the bad guys? In the 1989 Batman, you know, the one where he kills Joker, he dangles a thug off the side of a building to intimidate him. Hell, in Batman Begins, he dangles Flash, a cop, off the side of a building, drops him to within feet of the ground, and then hauls him back up. Isn't that the threat of death? If you think Batman really means he's going to kill Joker, isn't that the whole point? He wants you to believe that he would actually do it? Maybe that's why Joker then smiles and said, "You almost had me." This smells like the Superman doesn't kill argument after Man of Steel came out. And yes, I'm going to bitch about this again. Christopher Reeve's Superman takes away Zod's powers, so Zod is completely defenseless against Superman. Superman then proceeds to crush Zod's hand like an empty beer can and throws him into an Arctic chasm where he will freeze to death in minutes if the fall doesn't kill him first. They let another bad guy, Non, fall to his death. Then Lois punches the third bad guy, Ursa, causing her to fall to her death as well. Lois turns to Superman, who just watched her commit the murder, and he smiles at her. Yes, I know there's an extended cut that shows the villain survive, but if you're going to go there, you might as well also claim Greedo shot first. Christopher Reeve's Superman, the one everybody lifts up as this beautiful, pure version of Superman, callously and brutally murders defenseless villains. Henry Cavill's Superman, is immediately traumatized at having to take the life of a Kryptonian who is seconds away from unrepentantly burning people to death. Quit looking at these heroes through your rose-colored nostalgia glasses and just accept the fact that not every superhero movie has to meet your pristine, shiny, PG-rated milquetoast standards. Unless you're a critic who's already made up his or her mind to hate it before watching it, Zack Snyder's Justice League was an improvement in practically every single aspect of the movie compared to the theatrical release. And it's better because the movie is made for people like me and Marv Wolfman who want our characters to grow up along with us. The only thing I would have kept from the theatrical release was the mid-credits Flash Superman race. That harkens back to the Silver Age nostalgia, and it was a nice touch for longtime DC readers. See, I like the classic stuff. I also liked Aquaman walking on the pier while the White Stripes song played, and the Come Together cover used during the closing credits. But those songs are on my iTunes, so they don't have to be in the movie. There are some things I still don't understand, and some things I didn't like. As usual, I will get all the bad stuff out of the way before I go on to the stuff I like. Minor stuff. What truck driver would reach down to pick up food he dropped while speeding down a busy city street? I mean, I would have been fine with any kind of realistic distraction, but that just didn't work for me. Also minor, I still don't like the Nightcrawler vehicle. It seems so impractical. I mean, what is that, a crab? What the hell is that supposed to be? It reminds me of the one from the Lego Batman movie. Not that Lego Batman was a bad movie. I just think that that kind of vehicle worked better in an animated kids movie setting. I asked this in 2017 when the theatrical release came out, and I'll ask it again. If the Flash didn't get the job in the crime lab until the end of the movie, how did he get his powers? Please tell me the Flash movie will somehow explain this. Also, please tell me they'll use The Ballad of Barry Allen by Jim's Big Ego as their closing credits song. Is it needlessly long? Yes. But once again, you have to put it into context. Zack Snyder is not expecting to ever make another DC movie, maybe never make another superhero movie. So, if he's going to release his version of the Justice League on a streaming service, then he may as well put everything he wants to into it. Now, if this was 2017 and he was releasing it in the theaters, I would imagine he'd have it trimmed down to 2 hours and 45 minutes, maybe 2 hours 30. I think he just said, fuck it, put it all in. I woke up to watch it as soon as it dropped at 2 a.m. on March 18th, and I sat straight through. I don't care about the running time. I also don't care about all the slow motion scenes that so many people seem to have to bitch about. I have watched too many movie melees where I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on, so I'm okay with the slow motion. Now, the major stuff I didn't like. First, you have this beautiful, tender, poignant scene of Martha desperately trying to coax Lois out of her grief. The come back to the living line was especially moving. Then, after Martha leaves the apartment, Zack Snyder gives us a sucker punch, pun intended. As her eyes turn red, you find out it's really John Jones. I kind of understand Martian Manhunter disguising himself as Martha Kent in order to help Lois through her grief. Lois would certainly be more accepting of advice from Martha than she would from Swanwick. But that reveal turned one of the most human scenes in the movie into a jarring what the fuck moment. Second, Why did Bruce take so goddamn long to tell anybody about his nightmare? He should have told Diana right away, or at least mentioned it to Alfred. Why can't he just tell them he had a premonition that felt way too real to be dismissed, and that's why everybody needs to come together? Third, how the fuck does Darkseid and his army not know the location of their most crushing defeat? Their only defeat. Yes, I know. Diana says the Earth is one in a trillion worlds, but he is a new god. Steppenwolf said they knew the anti-life equation was there when they first invaded. Earth should have been targeted for millennia. Unless somewhere down the line we were supposed to find out New Genesis helped hide it. That's the only explanation I can think of involving DC characters. Fourth, why does Wonder Woman use her bracelet Shockwave against the terrorist? That power knocked both Doomsday and Steppenwolf on their ass, a Kryptonian and a new god. But she used it against an average human? Didn't that kill him? And to a lesser extent, cause needless damage to the Old Bailey? Since I'm asking questions, the movie makes a brief mention of the similar properties between the mother boxes and the Kryptonian ship. Additionally, the arrow of Artemis Hippolyta used to light up the Temple of the Amazons slips into place eerily similar to how the Kryptonian key slipped into place in the previous movies. Does this mean Apocalypse, Krypton, and the Greek gods have something in common? Have some kind of connection? Sure, disparate civilizations can develop similar technologies, but it would be interesting if it were more than just a coincidence. Part of the reason my friends wanted me to go with them to see the theatrical release when it first came out was I would be able to explain details and Easter eggs they may have missed. Sadly, most of that was scrubbed out. Fortunately, as I shifted the things I liked about the movie, there were some cool Easter eggs in the Snyder Cut. The Martian Manhunter cameo at the end was nice, if not more than a little anticlimactic due to the earlier scene. He's one of my favorite characters, and the nonchalant way Bruce handles a flying green alien floating outside his lake house is priceless. Some people were saying that scene didn't work for them because they didn't know who the character was. Okay, sorry you weren't aware of a founding member of the original League that's been around since the 50s, but that's why Easter eggs are for the hardcore fans. That being said, if Snyder really wanted a mind-blowing reveal at the end of the movie, he could have had Ryan Reynolds as Green Lantern, Stephen Amell as Green Arrow, or even Dwayne Johnson show up as Black Adam. As it turns out, the scene was supposed to have Green Lantern John Stewart speak to Batman. That would have been mind-blowing. I missed the corpse of Kilowog in Cyborg's vision of the future the first time through the movie. It's not quite what I meant when I said I wanted more Green Lanterns in Justice League, but I guess that'll do for now. We also got to see Darkseid's Omega Beams in that sequence. There's just something extra sinister about an evil god who shoots beams out of his eyes, and they don't even go in a straight line. They zigzag around and hit you, even if he's not looking at you. That's some Jack Kirby inspiration right there. The Gardner Fox reference was positively inspired. That's the company the burger-dropping truck driver was working for. For those of you who don't know, Gardner Fox created the Justice League, as well as the original superhero team, the Justice Society of America. That same scene shows the name of the hot dog brand as Granny Goodness, which is really strange because That's the name of the armored lady behind Darkseid. Granny Goodness is a weird name. Lots of that in Jack Kirby's Fourth World. Even though it's meant for irony, as the character is a demented sadist in charge of children. I noticed the ceremonial robe Hippolyta wears when she fires the arrow has a pattern vaguely like Asteria's armor Diana wears in Wonder Woman 1984. But since that movie is still a disappointment, who cares? Even before it was reported that it was part of Snyder's plans for the sequel, I had a hunch Lois Lane is pregnant at the end of Justice League, when Martha is moving her things back into the Kent home. Bruce says to Clark, "Congratulations, by the way." Now, he could have been talking about their engagement, but my first thought was that it meant he figured out Lois was pregnant, just like he did with Wonder Woman at the end of the Kingdom Come miniseries from the 90s. As I mentioned earlier, the Snyder Cut, even with its flaws, is superior to the theatrical release in almost every way imaginable. Every character improved in Snyder's version, even the ones who weren't even in the theatrical release. I've stated before that although Jared Leto's Joker is easily my least favorite live-action version of the character, I didn't totally hate him like many people did. Just before the Suicide Squad movie came out, I had read Scott Snyder's Death of the Family storyline from the comics. For those of you unfamiliar, this is a Joker that had his face surgically removed and later stapled back onto his head. So Jared Leto's gangsta Joker wasn't as off-putting to me as he was to others. The new nightmare scene wipes all that away. Joker and Batman have a tense and menacing conversation unlike any other live-action meeting. And it makes you want more from both of them. And for some reason, I can't stop laughing when Joker calls Mira my little fish stick. Darkseid got a barely noticeable passing mention in the theatrical release. In the movie, he's menacing even before you see him on screen. But his final scene also drives home how important Superman is. When Darkseid and the League stare each other down, Darkseid could have jumped through the boom tube with his army behind him. But instead, he chose to let the opportunity pass and prepare his armada. And I'll bet the number of ships and soldiers from the flashback would pale in comparison to what he would have brought in the sequel. Even though I've never been much for the Fourth World stories in general, I'm so pissed Warner Brothers decided not to proceed with the New Gods movie, especially in the wake of the Snyder Cut success. As I suspected, Lex Luthor's connection with the Kryptonian ship affected his mental stability, which explains his freakout at the end of Batman vs. Superman. Even geniuses are affected when they commune with gods, apparently. His discussion with Deathstroke takes a much different route than the post-credits scene from the theatrical release. And while the idea of the Legion of Doom is interesting, I like his deal with Slade Wilson much better in the Snyder Cut. Silas Stone has always been the absent dad in the comic books, and usually has a very shaky relationship with Victor, who resents Silas for turning him into Cyborg. You usually get the impression in the comics that Silas loves his son. He just has an addiction to his job as a scientist. The extended story he got in the Snyder Cut, and his death, solidifies how much he did love his son and believed in Victor's abilities to make the world a better place. In 2017, I stated on the Blatcast, and again in my podcast, that Steppenwolf was okay for a first movie villain. It helps get the origin story out of the way so you can really cut loose with the second movie. Or, as I put it back then, less of a Steppenwolf and more of a Steppenstone. Again, looking at what Joss Whedon has done in the past, I expected a generic villain who was there to do little more than make the heroes look good. The thing is, the Snyder Cut showed how great a villain he actually was. The few extra minutes spent giving his backstory made so much difference. He's vicious, brutal, and exponentially better. My key moment is, look at both versions of the movie. When the Atlantean guard is peering down and Steppenwolf shoots up from below. In the theatrical release, he looks like he's gasping for air. In the Snyder Cut, he looks like a predator about to tear the guard in half. Batman was simply better by removing all the cheesy Joss Whedon moments that belong more in the Schumacher movies. It took two whole movies for Joel Schumacher to destroy Tim Burton's Batman. Joss Whedon was able to do that with just post-production and reshoots. Hey, all you anti-Snyder Cut naysayers, you want to talk about what Batman doesn't do? He doesn't get flustered around Superman. And just because I feel like pissing some people off, you know what else Batman doesn't do? The fucking Bat-toozy. Superman's return was handled much better, from the discussion by the heroes to revive him, to the battle between the heroes before Superman's memories returned, to the walk through the ship among the various costumes with voiceovers from Jor-El and Jonathan Kent. It all built up the importance of the character to the other heroes and to the world. And from my wife's standpoint, the more shirtless Henry Cavill you can get, the better. Cyborg was amazing in this movie. I saw hints of it in the theatrical release, and I knew that there was going to be a big improvement with the Snyder Cut. But his story is so much better. He started out very similar to his origin in the comic books, angry with his father, feeling as though he had been cursed, and lashing out at those who tried to get close to him. By the end of the movie, he accepts his new abilities and realizes his full potential. Ray Fisher was simply fantastic. Watch his body movements when he's angry and lashing out at the world versus when he's using his abilities to help, and you'll understand what I mean. Flash was so much better than the frightened newbie he turned into in the Whedon cut. That climactic moment where the Unity has happened and the Earth is destroyed, Flash turns back time to save everyone and help Cyborg in the threat. There's all this wild CGI of buildings and roads and light posts returning to form as time is reversed, but amid all that, you get caught up in Barry's monologue, talking to his father and embracing his abilities. That's a great performance by Ezra Miller. Mira's attack on the water in Steppenwolf's body was badass. She drew blood. That has to be one of my favorite moments in the movie. If you think about it, other than Superman, she came closest to defeating Steppenwolf all on her own. I don't know why she has an accent in this movie. I don't really care. That was awesome. I know the fans that clamored for the Snyder Cut are now trying to get the Snyderverse restored to the DCEU. That would be nice. I obviously prefer Zack Snyder's version of these characters. I don't think that's going to happen. Then again, that's when I said when the whole release the Snyder Cut push began. The most important thing for me is that we finally got to see Zack Snyder's version. and see how vastly different things can be when studios and outside personnel keep their hands off a director's vision. Yes, it was flawed, but it was significantly better than the theatrical release. Characters that were stuck in a kiddie pool were given a deep dive. Humor befitting the heroes took precedent. A previously generic villain received motivation that made sense and became a brutal opponent. I've been a fan of the Justice League for over 40 years. The Snyder Cut satisfied the 7-year-old inside of me watching Super Friends on Saturday mornings, as well as the near 50-year-old who sips whiskey while watching the Justice's Gray version. The theatrical release of Justice League is for people who read comics written for kids in their childhood, but probably haven't picked one up in decades and think comic book movies have to be the same as those old kiddie comic books. Zack Snyder's Justice League is for people who read comics all their lives and want those characters and stories to grow up with them. On behalf of all of us who think like that, thank you, Zack Snyder. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.